This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
At the end of the month, it will have been exactly 4 years since the UK exited the EU and Boris Johnson celebrated Independence Day. But polls taken over the last few months have suggested a disillusion with the 2016 decision, with an average of polls showing 56% of Britons currently in favour of rejoining. Perhaps because of this, not long before Christmas, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, when asked whether Britain could ever rejoin the EU, said she thought that the direction of travel towards rejoining was clear. But even if the polls are right, and von der Leyen is right, and we wanted to do it, is it feasible or realistic to think of the UK going back into the EU? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what's changed in our relationship with the EU since we formally left? Peter Foster is public policy editor at the Financial Times. Peter Foster, how have things changed in our relations with the EU, practically and rhetorically, since Boris Johnson left Downing Street?
I think the biggest change is that diplomatic relations between London and Brussels have been normalised. And the biggest reason for that was the deal that Rishi Sunak did back in February 2023 on the post-Brexit trading arrangements for Northern Ireland. You'll remember that that was a big bone of contention between the Johnson government and Brussels, and indeed the short-lived Truss government and Brussels, with the UK on two occasions threatening to rip up the deal, threatening to breach its international law commitments and the treaty. And that had the effect of putting UK-EU relations into the diplomatic deep freeze. And so Rishi Sunak doing that deal essentially has thawed relations. Sunak and Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, have good relations. But we remain in a position where the UK and the EU has quite limited trading relationship with the EU based on a basic free trade agreement that was negotiated by Lord David Frost and Boris Johnson. And we've seen one or two other things come down the pipes, the deal to rejoin the Horizon Europe Science and Research Programme, for example. But nonetheless, we're still in the same space that we were with the deal that Johnson and Frost negotiated. It's just now operationalized because we've cleared the hurdle with Northern Ireland.
Let's look beyond Northern Ireland now and look at the broader question of trade relations between the EU and the UK. I thought there were a whole series of things which we might have to put into place on the border with regard to EU goods coming in that have somehow never materialised. Can you just take me through that one?
When Brexit actually took effect on the 1st of January 2021, the EU immediately put up its full border. So goods moving from Great Britain across the Dover Straits into the EU faced a full panoply of checks at the border, particularly on animal and plant products. But we didn't do that because we wanted to, as the government would say, prioritise trade flows. So five times, actually, the British government has delayed imposing those checks. But as of the 31st of January this year, they will begin to phase in checks on goods coming from EU into GB. And that starts with what they call export health certificates, so new paperwork on animal and plant products will need to be there. And then from April, there will be physical inspections at the border. And then from October, all goods coming from Europe into GB will require what's called safety and security and declaration. So for the first time, EU businesses that trade with the UK are going to start to feel the effects of the trade border that was erected between EU and GB when Johnson and Frost did their trade deal.
I seem to recall that a lot of British companies that dealt with the EU actually stopped trading into the EU as a consequence of those things being imposed at the EU end. Does that mean that EU companies are likely to stop trading with us?
It's a good question. And the answer to that question is we don't know. I think what you saw on the UK side was smaller businesses basically giving up on the paperwork, basically giving up on the cost, but larger businesses absorbing the costs and absorbing the paperwork. The question I think that's unknown is the extent to which EU businesses that are less reliant on the GB, because it's one of 28 markets that they can trade with, whether EU businesses will go to the same trouble as UK businesses did to preserve their relationships. And whether EU businesses will absorb the costs. If they don't, that means higher costs for UK businesses that are importing for Europe that are using EU suppliers. And then in some circumstances, it may be that if you're a European company, you're trading with 27 other countries or 26 other countries on a single set of rules, that you just can't be bothered to send your chemicals or whatever it might be to the UK. And I don't think it amounts to massive chaos at the border, queues at the border. It just creates the sand in the gears of trade, that little marginal friction between the EU and Great Britain.
Since you mentioned Horizon, are there other bits of association with the EU where we have got closer or anticipating getting closer again?
Not really with the current government. I think there are fairly fixed parameters. There is some work going on in terms of energy cooperation and energy interconnector exchange, but fundamentally the parameters of the relationship have been set. We have seen one or two little tweaks. For example, there was a threat of tariffs on electric vehicles, both for vehicles coming from the EU into Great Britain and from Great Britain into the EU, threat of 10% tariffs because they weren't going to be sufficiently locally made in order to enter the EU and the UK tariff-free, the so-called rules of origin. That deal was done in December, rather under sufferance by the EU, but essentially to avoid Chinese car makers, on whom we're trying to become less reliant, taking advantage of those tariffs being imposed on goods in both directions. But fundamentally, the deal is the deal, and the EU is not keen to rewrite the deal at the moment. And so, except at the margin, there really isn't going to be a fundamental transformation in that trading relationship.
Now, Peter, here's the big one as far as I can see. During the long Brexit negotiations, remember all that, a lot was made of the freedom to diverge and the use that could be made of that freedom. Has that happened? And as they used to say in exam papers, if not, why not?
So actually, there has been very limited divergence from the EU for the simple reason that when you diverge, you create an alternative set of rules. So the cost-benefit analysis of doing that has to be positive. And what you find is that very often it's not the case, because that set of rules, that EU red tape, is also the set of rules that gives you access to a market of 450 million people. So there hasn't been much divergence. And in fact, the second piece of that puzzle is that even if the UK stands still, the EU is moving forward all the time. So it's creating regulations on artificial intelligence, on carbon border taxes, on supply chain management, on plastic packaging. And so what you see is actually what industry is calling Brexit 2.0 issues, where the future rules that come in from the EU create fresh barriers to trade between Great Britain and the EU, because British businesses now have to conform with those carbon border taxes, with the new rules on plastic packaging directives. That is an ongoing, evolving picture.
Peter Foster. According to Michel Barnier, the man who negotiated the Brexit agreement on the EU side, the EU today is no longer the EU that the UK left. So what's changed since the 2016 referendum? Moshe Rahman is Managing Director for Europe at Eurasia Group, which advises investors on political risk. Moshe Rahman, is the current EU the same one we voted to leave back in 2016?
I think it's changed. It's become a bit more coherent regarding fiscal and economic policy, and that's because that's one area where we have seen a degree of integration. As a result of the coronavirus pandemic, the EU decided to issue a lot of debt and then transfer a lot of that to countries to help them rebound. And so you've seen a lot more centralization of economic policy and fiscal policy. And I think the EU has become a tad more coherent on the geostrategic, geopolitical side. And that's obviously a consequence of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If you think about what the European Union has done in that regard, sanctions, a lot more defense spending, and enlargement is back on the table as a foreign policy tool after being dormant for two decades. Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Montenegro, and others, they're all now looking to join. Interesting, and enlargement will be the vehicle through which a lot of interesting reforms will now take place over the medium to longer term, I suspect. But there is a lot more fragmentation. Decision-making is a lot more diffuse. There is no real leadership. Both France and Germany have weaker leaders and are struggling with some significant domestic political challenges.
Right. Very briefly, if it is possible to be brief on this, what is the economic situation across the EU?
It's holding up, but it's not particularly impressive. The euro area avoided a deep recession in 2023, despite the impacts of the Ukraine war, but growth was subpar and there's persistent inflation. And those will be characteristics that I think define the outlook not only this year, but going forward.
Is that higher inflation than in Britain or lower or roughly the same?
Roughly the same.
Okay. We started the programme by talking, among other things, about what Ursula von der Leyen said at the end of November about, she was asked a question about Britain's future in Europe, and she says she thought the direction of travel was to back towards the EU. One wonders whether, in saying that, she was aware and had been looking at the polls in Britain about that prospect.
Yes, I think she has. Look, I think the Europeans are really distracted, right? There's a lot of things they're dealing with. Elections, Ukraine, domestic political challenges we've talked a bit about. But they do see a UK question. And I think they're just unsure about, you know, over what time frame does this become important? So there is some informal thinking taking place, you know, at the most senior levels of the Commission and I think major EU capitals about what a revitalized relationship could look like over the short and medium term, even if there's no discussion taking place.
Now, what do you think the UK brings that other nations might actually want?
Well, look, I think the single biggest thing is that the context within which Europe and the UK are now operating is just fundamentally different than 2016. There is a lot more geopolitical volatility. There is a lot more geopolitical uncertainty. China today is a factor in Europe. That just wasn't the case in 2016. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has completely transformed the way the European Union is thinking about security in its near neighbourhood and its security architecture and enlargement. And then, of course, you've got the context of potentially Donald Trump returning to the US presidency. And that's an existential nightmare for some countries in the EU, in particular Germany, that has no nuclear deterrent of its own. And so what does the UK offer? Well, the UK offers, number one, a strategic culture, a capable military, and a nuclear deterrent. And all of those things are much more fundamentally important today, given the context I've just described, than they were in 2016.
Do you mean that as a result of these things, they actively look at what they can do and what Britain can do to bring the two closer together? I mean, let's not even think about even the formal structures now, but whatever it is that can be done should be done.
As I say, there's no organised discussion taking place, but there is some informal thinking. And I think, you know, what's interesting to my mind is the generation of officials that delivered Brexit in 2016, they have moved on. And we've also got an entirely new set of leaders at the European level that are, I think, have a different predisposition towards the UK. When Brexit originally hit, I think there was a view in France that this will rebalance power within the European Union to France's advantage. actually, I think what's happened in France is they've realized the UK's absence is a problem. They miss their discussions with the UK and the strategic discussions they could have with the UK. They don't think Germany is a partner and that is capable of doing the kind of thinking the UK does, again, because Germany just doesn't have that culture. And so I think there's a kind of recognition now that there's a vacuum, there's a gap. These areas of the relationship, I think, are more important today than they were in 2016, and I think would drive and influence the way the EU thinks about engaging with the UK, or the UK to say, look, we're interested in rejoining.
Mujtaba Rahman. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes our episode on the situation on the West Bank, on Ukraine's second winter of war, and the one on Britain's new political demography. So now, let's throw the question forward. How realistic is it to imagine Britain rejoining the EU in the foreseeable future? Anand Menon is director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe, and Jill Ratter is senior fellow at the Institute of Government, and she directed the organisation's work on Brexit. Jill Ratter, can we just explore first whether it is possible in principle for us to rejoin the EU? Is there a mechanism that we would have to use?
Yes, the EU is open to applications for membership from any European country. We're still a European country, so we can always apply, but there is a process for that. And so there are sort of hurdles we have to do. There are conditions that lay down, but also, first of all, you have to apply and get sort of candidate status. That means that every existing EU member state has to agree to open talks with you. And then there's a process of negotiation. In many cases, that takes quite a long time. And then there has to be formal agreement from all EU member states. And they have to do that in line with their sort of constitutional requirements. So that could require referendums in some of those member states before the UK could accede. So yes, we can apply whenever we want. But whether the EU accepts our candidacy is a different question.
Anand Menon, we've heard that the European Union now is not really the same as the one we voted to leave in 2016. How does that change things with regard to any potential British application?
Well, from our point of view, it changes things in the sense that we're joining an institution that looks and feels quite different to the one that we left. We have a European Commission that is very, very activist. And there might be those amongst the Europeans who remember our track record as a member state and who are slightly wary of having in a country that was traditionally pro-status quo. We like the European Union as it was immediately after the single market and didn't much like the changes afterwards. And I think there will be voices on the European side saying, actually, do we really want to bring in a country that has a track record of trying to block progress?
Can we look through some of the things which, and obviously this is all kind of hypothetical, but there were a whole series of conditions attached to Britain's membership, things that we weren't part of, that other people were part of and so on, which if there was in these circumstances a reapplication to join, would we be discussing joining on anything like the same terms as before?
Absolutely not. And bear in mind, they weren't conditions on our membership. The sorts of opt-outs we had from Schengen, from the euro, were things we negotiated as a member state. We essentially said we're not signing up to that unless we get an opt-out.
Now, let's remind ourselves very briefly about what Schengen is.
Schengen is the border-free zone, which involves most, though not all, EU member states, which basically means that you don't have checks or borders to travel from one country to another. We had an opt-out from that. Now, in terms of what we might be looking at if we were to reapply to join, I think a Schengen opt-out is possible because we're an island. I think that changes things quite fundamentally. On the euro, I find it inconceivable they'll give us a formal opt-out at the negotiation stage because the European Union is keen that everyone eventually joins the euro. Whether they would subsequently force us to join were we to become a member state, I'm less certain about that. But I think the paper opt-out would go. And the one thing I'm pretty convinced about is that famous budget rebate that Margaret Thatcher negotiated, that will not be up for discussion again this time round.
Jill, where did we get to with that? Because you just nodded with that. Was that rebate forever and ever that Margaret Thatcher negotiated, or would we have had to renegotiate it anyway?
It had been renegotiated. Thatcher got a very hefty rebate. She actually managed to knock two-thirds off our net contribution. Remember, at the time, the EU budget was mainly agriculture, and the UK didn't get very much out of the CAP. So she got a really, really big rebate. reduced later by Tony Blair. But I think Anand is right that consistently rankled with the EU that the UK had negotiated that rebate. And I think it's very unlikely, particularly as the EU is facing sort of budget crunches. And potentially, you have to remember who some of the other potential candidate member states are. One of the things that the EU is facing down the line are the costs of reconstruction in Ukraine, if it has to help that when the war ends. So I think the idea that they would be cutting a UK returning much slack, I think is highly unlikely. It would take some incredibly skillful negotiating by the British.
Let's look at the question of whether or not the EU would want us. Obviously, public opinion has changed for the moment here in Britain. What would they, Jill, would they be looking for, however, in terms of a commitment politically if they were going to engage in a process that would take years?
Well, it's very interesting because the UK clearly meets a lot of the formal conditions that are set out about being an applicant, about, you know, state of the rule of law and the economy and things like that. But I think one of the difficult things about UK membership has been how contested membership was even while we were a member state. That's a big contrast to most European countries. We've seen some rise of Euroscepticism across Europe. But generally, the major sort of political parties were both pretty committed to EU membership everywhere else. But I think it's really difficult now to see the EU embarking on quite difficult negotiations if they thought, well, we might be negotiating, say, with a second-term Labour government. But where is the Conservative Party now? Is the Conservative Party going to honour any agreement? Or would we be going through all that hassle, all that process now, only for the moment that there's a British general election and the UK demanding another exit deal? So I think until there's really pretty much a settled consensus, both among the public, but also of the major political parties who are likely to form a government in the UK, I think it would be very hard to see the EU devoting huge amounts of time and effort to prioritising UK membership.
You've talked about consensus both amongst political parties and amongst the public. We'll come on to the political parties in a moment. What does a consensus in the public look like on anything, frankly? Anand?
On public opinion, there's a couple of things. I mean, firstly, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis now. As part of that cost of living crisis, a lot of people are blaming Brexit for economic outcomes that I think have got very little, if anything, to do with Brexit. So let's wait and see what public opinion looks like if and when our economy is doing well, is the first thing. The second crucial thing about public opinion is, yes, far more people now think the decision to leave was the wrong decision. But actually, the striking thing about public opinion is just how lacking in salience the EU issue is. I think it's 6 or 7% of the public now think Brexit is the most important issue facing the country. And in focus groups we've done in our work at UK and Changing Europe, one of the things we found is that both leavers and remainers are united by one thing, which is a desire to talk about something else. So just because the public might have changed its minds about whether Brexit was a good thing or a bad thing doesn't mean that there's a real groundswell of opinion there saying, ooh, let's have another big negotiation and another referendum. I think that's the last thing on people's minds.
Jill, I think there is, within the polls, something of a reflection on what business has been saying about whether or not it has suffered as a consequence of Brexit or whether or not it wants to have closer relationships with the EU. Is there, within the political parties, any kind of recognition that if growth is your number one issue going forward, that actually you need to find a new relationship with Europe economically?
The problem, though, is that that option for deepening the relationship is really quite unattractive because it would mean the UK formally committing to becoming a rule taker of the EU without the seat at the table. Then that would be quite a difficult sell, which I think is why nobody wants it. Also, at the moment, still mean committing to free movement, which we know remains controversial. So I think there's maybe an intellectual recognition that a better relationship with the EU would help with growth, but at the moment it's not being promoted as one of the instruments that either party wants to take up.
And then to play devil's advocate here for a moment, the first bit of devil's advocacy is that we are de facto rule takers anyway. In other words, we don't diverge significantly from the EU economically because we can't afford to. And the second one is that actually getting rid of freedom of movement has far from leading to a fall in net migration. There has actually been an increase. How does one deal with those arguments?
Well, firstly, not diverging is very different to being a rule taker. We might be deciding in our parliament that we're not going to scrap all the EU laws on our statute books. But that is very different from a situation in which the EU passes laws without us at the table and they become the law of the land here, which is what single market membership would imply. And I think in terms of democratic theory, there are obvious problems with that. And if you're one of those people that thinks actually sovereignty is the reason why we left the European Union, being in the single market and not a member state is far worse than being a member on those grounds. So I think it is very different. On the second point about freedom of movement, I suppose the counter argument would be, yep, we have inward migration at record levels now, over 700,000, but that is down precisely to what the government has decided to do. We have chosen an immigration policy that has led to those numbers. It is completely within our control to do something about that. The government can change the rules on immigration. It would change immigration. And that is very different to a situation under freedom of movement where you're committed to allowing European citizens to come here and work.
So that then leads us to this final question, whether there is a new dispensation that we could find which would somehow maximise the benefit of our trade closeness to Europe without giving us any of the other problems. Where would we look, Jill, for such a solution?
Well, I think at the start we're going to look at sort of some incremental add-on agreements. So we've already seen some moves to knock off bits of the hard edges that we've seen. Just before Christmas, the UK announced that it was changing its rules on school visits from France in a bilateral deal. We've rejoined Horizon and Copernicus. So there are sort of areas where we seem to be coming in line, but the UK isn't really registering as a big issue in European politics, which have loads of other things to deal with at the moment. The interesting thing, I think, is if global politics change and we're in a very uncertain time, is whether the EU changes enough, both internally with the European elections this year, but also the external environment changes enough that there's interest in looking and saying, well, is there a different relationship to the stark choice that was offered to the UK by Michel Barnier? Is there a different relationship that we would be prepared to offer a big member state that doesn't really probably want to be a full member, and that maybe we don't want as a full member either, and, you know, go back to some of the language of Theresa May and develop a more genuine bespoke relationship, maybe with quite a big security dimension, but also one that eases those trade relations quite significantly. But at the moment, that's not on the table.
That reminds me of that phrase, cakeism. And, which is the idea that you could somehow leave and still get the benefits of membership. And the suggestion Jill kind of partially makes here, and I hope I get you right here, Jill, is that actually with the passage of time, we might move to a cakeist position. Do you think so?
I think we're pretty much already in a cakeist position. The problem is I do not foresee any circumstances, including a second Trump presidency, which would shift the EU towards accepting that kind of position. One of the problems is the EU is about to embark on a round of enlargement that's going to be very, very difficult. And with enlargement comes the need to ensure that the rule-based system that is the EU continues to function. So I think the notion that they would give a state like the UK special treatment at a time when internal pressures from member states to maybe relax some of the rules, give special treatment, is going to be growing is, frankly, for the birds. I mean, I have to say, I find it very, very hard to foresee a time when a British Prime Minister initiates a debate that is going to be massively divisive and over which we now have a real history to start a process that won't be finished within his or her term as Prime Minister. This requires a lot of things that are absent from British politics at the moment. It requires consensus, it requires long-termism, it requires patience. So I struggle at the moment to foresee a moment when that is going to happen.
Anand Menon there with Jill Rutter. My thanks to them and to Peter Foster and Mujtaba Rahman. My conclusion is, I wonder what future generations, the ones not traumatised by the Brexit battles, will make of it all in the next decades. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Sophie Eastor, Kirsty Knight and Alex Lewis. The sound engineer was Rod Farker and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and in my new BBC Radio 4 podcast, Cold Therapy, I'm going to be looking at the science behind the surprising benefits of the cold. How turning down the temperature in your house can improve your blood sugar and fat metabolism. How exercising in the cold can help you get fitter, quicker, and more easily. And how cold water swimming can boost your mood and might even protect your brain. Based on the latest research, we'll reveal some simple, safe, and practical things you can do and the effect they'll have if you choose to invite in the colder side of life. I hope you'll subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.